dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. I'm going to start tonight's program by reading you an extraordinary letter. Its writer is John Brady Kiesling, a career diplomat who has served in various United States embassies for 2 decades. This is his letter of resignation from the U.S. Foreign Service, dated February 27, 2003, addressed to Secretary of State Colin L. Powell. Dear Mr. Secretary, I'm writing you to submit my resignation from the Foreign Service of the United States and from my position as political counselor in U.S. Embassy Athens. Effective March 7th. I do so with a heavy heart. The baggage of my upbringing included a felt obligation to give something back to my country. Service as a U.S. diplomat was a dream job. I was paid to understand foreign languages and cultures, to seek out diplomats, politicians, scholars, and journalists, and to persuade them that U.S. interests and theirs fundamentally coincided. My faith in my country and its values was the most powerful weapon in my diplomatic arsenal. It is inevitable that during 20 years with the State Department I would become more sophisticated and cynical about the narrow and selfish bureaucratic motives that sometimes shaped our policies. Human nature is what it is. And I was rewarded and promoted for understanding human nature. But until this administration, it had been possible to believe that by upholding the policies of my president, I was also upholding the interests of the American people and the world. I believe it no longer. The policies we are now asked to advance are incompatible not only with American values, but also with American interests. Our fervent pursuit of war with Iraq is driving us to squander the international legitimacy that had been America's most potent weapon of both offense and defense since the days of Woodrow Wilson. We have begun to dismantle the largest and most effective web of international relationships the world has ever known. Our current course will bring instability and danger, not security. The sacrifice of global interest to domestic politics and to bureaucratic self-interest is nothing new, and it is certainly not a uniquely American problem. Still, we have not seen such systematic distortion of intelligence, such systematic manipulation of American opinion since the war in Vietnam. The September 11th tragedy left us stronger than before, rallying around us a vast international coalition to cooperate for the first time in a systematic way against the threat of terrorism. But rather than take credit for those successes and build on them, this administration has chosen to make terrorism a domestic political tool, enlisting a scattered and largely defeated Al-Qaeda as its bureaucratic ally. We spread disproportionate terror and confusion in the public mind, arbitrarily linking the unrelated problems of terrorism and Iraq. The result, and perhaps the motive, is to justify a vast misallocation of shrinking public wealth to the military and to weaken the safeguards that protect American citizens from the heavy hand of government. September 11th did not do as much damage to the fabric of American society as we seem determined to do to ourselves. Is the Russia of the late Romanovs really our model, a selfish, superstitious empire thrashing toward self-destruction in the name of a doomed status quo? we should ask ourselves why we have failed to persuade more of the world that a war with Iraq is necessary. We have, over the past 2 years, done too much to assert to our world partners that narrow and mercenary U.S. interests override the cherished values of our partners. Even where our aims were not in question, our consistency is at issue. The model of Afghanistan is little comfort to allies wondering on what basis we plan to rebuild the Middle East, and in whose image and interests. Have we indeed become blind? As Russia is blind in Chechnya, as Israel is blind in the occupied territories, to our own advice that overwhelming military power is not the answer to terrorism? After the shambles of post-war Iraq joins the shambles in Grozny and Ramallah, it will be a brave foreigner who forms ranks with Micronesia to follow where we lead. We have a coalition still, a good one. The loyalty of many of our friends is impressive, a tribute to American moral capital built up over a century. But our closest allies are persuaded less that war is justified than that it would be perilous to allow the U.S. to drift into complete solipsism. Loyalty should be reciprocal. Why does our president condone the swaggering and contemptuous approach to our friends and allies this administration is fostering, including its most senior officials? Has odorant dom metuant really become our motto? And that translates from the Latin as let them hate so long as they fear, a favorite saying of the Roman Emperor Caligula. I urge you to listen to America's friends around the world. Even here in Greece, purported hotbed of European anti-Americanism, we have more and closer friends than the American newspaper reader can possibly imagine. Even when they complain about American arrogance, Greeks know that the world is a difficult and dangerous place, and they want a strong international system, with the U.S. and EU in close partnership. When our friends are afraid of us rather than for us, it is time to worry. And now they are afraid. Who will tell them convincingly that the United States is as it was, a beacon of liberty, security, and justice for the planet? Mr. Secretary, I have enormous respect for your character and ability. You have preserved more international credibility for us than our policy deserves, and salvaged something positive from the excesses of an ideological and self-serving administration. But your loyalty to the President goes too far. We are straining beyond its limits an international system we built with such toil and treasure, a web of laws, treaties, organizations, and shared values that sets limits on our foes far more effectively than it ever constrained America's ability to defend its interests. I am resigning because I have tried and failed to reconcile my conscience with my ability to represent the current U.S. administration. I have confidence that our democratic process is ultimately self-correcting, and hope that in a small way I can contribute from outside to shaping policies that better serve the security and prosperity of the American people and the world we share. I have been reading the letter of resignation from John Brady Keesling of the U.S. Foreign Service, dated February 27th, addressed to Secretary of State Colin Powell. In his letter, Mr. Keesling said he's counting on the American democratic process to result in self-correction. But it will only do so if more people follow Mr. Keesling's example of conscience and action. As you will hear in tonight's program, self-correction is increasingly unlikely to occur at the ballot box. We'll present evidence tonight of the election fraud that led to George Bush becoming president, and also recent discoveries that have called into question the validity of all elections carried out with computerized voting machines. Our first speaker is Greg Pallast, an investigative journalist with the London Guardian and the BBC, who's author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. This talk we're about to hear was given last summer in Seattle, so some of the references may seem dated. Some, it turns out, were also prophetic.
I don't know. What? I don't know what you're standing up for. Didn't Catherine Harris tell you to, like, move on? what are you all doing here? You know, it's like, move on. Get over it. If you pick up this month's Harper's Magazine, Catherine Harris says I'm twisted and maniacal. But as the philosopher Chubby Checker says, let's twist. Catherine, because I was reading the Washington Post today, which has discovered that there were some problems on the floor. 2 days ago, they just reported, the Washington Post, that there were some problems in the Florida election in Florida in November 2000. They're on the story. 30 years since the Washington, let's see, this is the 30th anniversary of Watergate, which is a milestone in journalism because that means it's 30 years since the Washington Post has broken an investigative story. Yeah. Oh, I've done a couple of investigative stories for BBC Television and Guardian newspapers. It started out on a night I took off, November 6th of 2000. I was sitting in London with my family watching My Democracy here in the States, and I'm seeing people get in front of the BBC television cameras, and they're saying, you know, I tried to vote, but, you know, I, by the way, sound of, oh, that's not me, that's a car out there. God. Look, I'm trying to, great. I didn't want the FBI agents in the audience to be making noise. I mean, just record. Take careful notes. So I'm watching all, you know, this, the television screen. I'm seeing like one black face. First as a black face comes up. I try to vote in Florida, and they try to vote. They said I was a criminal. I knocked off a 7-Eleven in Utah in 1964. I'm a criminal. I can't vote, even though it wasn't me. Someone else gets up. And they say, I tried to vote, but I couldn't find my name on the voter registry. And they said, you're out of luck, et cetera. And one face after another, and they're all black. And then the story just disappeared from the TV screens after a couple days, and we got onto Chads and Butterflies. Now, if, for those of you who watched a program called Politically Incorrect a few weeks ago when I was on, I was called a conspiracy nut, which always gets a big laugh from the conspirators. And so November 6, 7, 8, in my conspiracy nut mind, I'm thinking, maybe there's some kind of computer program which is like, you know, zooming in on black names on the voter rolls and removing them. And here is the program. This is or as part of. Oops, just disappeared on me. It's okay. Bill. Whatever. Yeah. We're in Seattle, so I got to be a little more specific because I say computer programs, a database which is put into an Excel spreadsheet. I usually say Lotus, but here I got to say Excel. And I'm in the town that invented the phrase "you have performed an illegal activity." Oh no, I haven't, Bill. In fact, what I don't understand is why they don't, you know, what you would expect on the computer screen is a little note to come up that says, Mr. Gates is terribly sorry for one more goddamn flaw in his program. Illegal. So, I want to talk about an illegal, perform an illegal operation with a computer, if not a pornographic operation with a computer. So I got this out of the files of the Florida Secretary of State, Catherine Harris, her Department of Elections. There was a list of 57,700 people who are listed, who were marked for removal Harris in May before the elections, and then sent out this list saying, remove to each Florida election supervisor, remove these names from the voter lists because they are felons, and you can't vote in Florida if you've committed a felony crime in Florida. Okay, it's only in the Deep South you have these laws, but that's the law. If illegal people are registered, they should be thrown off the list. Okay? Fine. One problem with the list, and I was looking at this one, and you can come here and you see this whole, because I actually have the whole thing. I got CD-ROMs, which are cracked by volunteers and put into nice little spreadsheets. And it said, it caught my eye, like, for example, right on this list, Thomas Cooper. And he was convicted on January 30th, 2007. Catherine. I'm looking through the list, and I'm finding a lot of people convicted in the future, in the next millennium, which is really great. Catherine Harris, detective in the future, looks through a crystal ball and zooms out and grabs those bad guys and brings it back and says, you can't vote in Florida, we know what you're going to do. But 90, how many, so I go through people convicted in the future, people convicted before they're born. Lots of interesting names. There's a whole criminal gang apparently called Jane Doe. And we went through with a team from Salon.com, volunteers, went down into Florida, went through the list, statisticians, demographers, you name it, and the county election supervisors themselves, and we determined that it looks like of the 57,700 names, at least 90.2% of the people on the list are innocent. Innocent. Well, not quite innocent, because 54% of them are not white. So not completely innocent, because over half the people are black. Now, black, I mean, how do I know that? Because if you go down through the list and you come up, take a look at this stuff or get it in the book or see Harper's, it has right next to the voter's name. Black, black, white, white, black, black, black. Right next to the voter's name. It's like a South African police roster. No one's guessing when they took the names off. They weren't guessing. They knew. They knew the color of those votes, too. Right? 80% of all black people registered in Florida voted. 10-1, they voted for Al Gore. Florida Secretary of State Harris named George Bush the winner of Florida and therefore the winner of the White House by 537 votes, 57,700 names marked for removal. You do the arithmetic, you tell me who was elected president, right? You read that in your papers. Actually, you did. I have to say, in all fairness, I did. That was reported in the Washington Post with a byline, with my analysis under my byline. Come on, let's be fair. I broke the story in Britain in November, 2 weeks after the election. Al Gore was still in the race, and the Post ran that story in June. They're on it. They're on case. And one of the things that the Washington Post people didn't let me write, and because their investigative team, they said that they looked into it. They looked into it, and what they couldn't find is that it was deliberate. They said, well, it's an error. It's just an error, which is a hell of a thing to call the President of the United States. But a big error. Our democracy is a big error. So always very interesting, because that's always, look at what's happening with September 11th. It's like, first you have the first state denial. Ron Ziegler was the press secretary for Richard Nixon. You say that prior truth is now inoperable. So, first they, we didn't know anything. Oh, we knew something, but so the prior truth is inoperable. Here's the new truth. So Harris, now here's the interesting thing. Harris did not deny. instead of you, I was twisted and maniacal, but she didn't say I was wrong. She did say, yeah, that's pretty big news, which is not covered. She didn't say I was wrong. She said thousands of people were targeted, most of them were black, but she blamed everyone else. We'll get back to that. Deliberate. Wasn't deliberate, said the Washington Post. There, I was at Columbia School of Journalism with Seymour Hersh, another investigative reporter fired by the New York Times. Get your two Pulitzer Prizes out of here. We don't do investigative reporting anymore. But the Washington Post, they didn't bother getting the list, and they didn't bother. So I said, did you go through the emails? Well, we didn't get a chance, because you can get the emails right out of Catherine Harris's computer. That's what I did, and her office's computers. And remember Thomas Cooper, 2007, guy in the future? I found 500 people convicted in the future. Okay? And someone, a clerk in the office of Catherine Harris's Division of Elections, it was actually her predecessor, Sandra Morthau, who was another Jeb Bush protege. The clerk wrote a note, an email note saying, my God, we've got people convicted in the future. What do we do? Now, I went to LA City Schools, but even I know what you do. If you take away people's civil rights by accident through a clerical error, give them back their civil rights. But the Florida politicos at the top of the office wrote back, we have it in writing, if you blank out the conviction dates, no one will know. Okay. Just an error. So who came up with this list? So I went a little bit farther. Who came up with this? Now, if you've read Michael Moore's Stupid White Man, you would know the answer to that is a company called DBT of Florida. It's owned by a company, Choice Point of Atlanta. Actually, that's another way I get in my stories into the press. And Michael Moore, in his polemics, picks up a lot of the reportage from my work in Britain. And so that's how I sneak it around the electronic Berlin Wall that they've erected to keep my stuff out. You know, I say, well, I can't get it into ABC, so, you know, give it to the fat guy in the chicken suit. We'll get it in. We get the drips and... Who came up with the list? DBT, but actually that's the only part of the story. I'll give you a little bit more. Before Database Technologies, there was another company, Professional Services, which was paid $5,000 to come up with this list of potential of felons. Okay, and they were fired. They were fired by the Florida Department of Elections, and Database Technologies has good Republican credentials, was hired to replace them. First, there was a bid. Database Technologies was the highest bidder. They said, let's go to a no-bid contract. No-bid Database Technology wins. Now, they fired one company that was paid $5,000 a year to replace them with Database Technologies, which in the first year was paid $2.3 million. Oh. That interested me. There's 100,000 reporters down in Florida, which interested exactly none of them. But I thought it was kind of interesting, and I thought, well, let me get a hold of this contract. I mean, $2.3 million, for what? For 90.2% wrong? Well, I got a little suspicious of that because DBT, Division of Choice Point, these guys work for the FBI. They do manhunts. And the FBI doesn't pay millions to them to do their database searches for 90.2% wrong. They've got 20 million. This company keeps 20 billion records on you. They know, sir, they know what you did on your third date in high school. And they know, and now they'll be hired to know which of you are patriots. Okay? But they know. They know whether Thomas Cooper of Ohio is the same Thomas Cooper of Tampa who will commit a crime in the future. Okay, they know. In fact, they were paid. One of the reasons that they were picked no bid is that they promised to do, in their contract, 273 million cross-checks. Okay? But right next to the 273 million cross-checks is a handwritten note in Catherine Harris's office that says, don't need. Or don't want, because when you have a list of 57,000 names and half of them are black, in other words, half of them are may not. What Catherine Herrera is called potential felons. No, there's no such thing as a potential felon in America. That's what makes us great. But they were definitely potential Gore voters. But maybe that the two concepts kind of like, in her mind, you know, felon Gore voter. We know what their crime was, right? So it wasn't that they didn't need the cross checks, but maybe they didn't want the cross checks. And they also got a bit of a, they also got a note from Database Technologies, a little worried that they might be sued, and in fact they have been now by the NAACP, which got my information. And the Database Technologies said, don't blame us, because we wrote a note. Many notes, I mean, we have meetings, we have minutes of those meetings, so please don't sue us because we sent in notes that said, and we will read it to you, it says right here, we told them there are a, quote, a significant number of people who are not felons on the list. There's innocent people. We gave you a list with innocent people, and they said, here's how you cut it down. How far do you cut it down? A list of innocent people? Well, I went to Bob Butterworth, who's the Attorney General. And I said, Mr. Attorney General, if someone votes who's a felon, can't, has no right to vote in Florida, they have no right to vote, what would you do? He said, I'd bust him. I'd arrest him. I said, get to work, buddy. Start with Thomas Cooper before he commits the crime. Got 57,000 names to work on. He said, I know about the list. I said, you know about the list? Well, how many of these people have you nailed? There's nearly 60,000 criminals out there, felons hankering for more jail time so they can vote for the school board. How many felons out there? 57,000. He said, how many cases you work on? I said, six. 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 Oh, I said, what happened to the crime wave? He says, yeah, there's a crime wave. The state was defrauded. We got a bogus list. I said, hey, who are you going to cuff? He said, no. Florida's unusual. We're one of the only states where the Attorney General cannot act against fraud, on fraud against the state. The investigation. I said, well, who does it? The investigation has to be done. He said, the investigation has to be done by Catherine Harris. She's right on it. She's right on it. By the way, that phrase about significant number of people who are not felons, those innocent people, innocent black people, innocent democratic people, was obtained through withering cross-examination of a company in special hearings, not by a regular session of a U.S. Congressional committee, which wouldn't take it on, and not even by the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, which tried hard, but by brilliant cross-examination, 600 pages of transcript by maybe the most brilliant member of Congress we have, who actually took all the documentation of mine and went through it and put that company on the spot, Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney in Atlanta. Yeah. They'll get that uppity black woman yet. Well, I'm looking through this contract. Let's see if I can find it. I realize I don't have the document here. This is a cheap way to pull the book out, huh? But there's a page in because I have photocopies of different documents. This book, I'm a document freak. You know, I'm always holding up documents. You know, I've got a document here. I just like Joe McCarthy to, you know, I've got a document here. Except the difference between him and I is I've got the document. Right? So on page actually 29 of the book, for those who are reading along, you know, hymn number 12. It's not very well laid out, but it actually is a photocopy from the contractor, part of the page, which is deep. It says confidential and trade secret. Confidential and secret, a part of the money and work to be done. In a government contract, I've had government contracts, secret, confidential? BBC said, again, you know, the U.S. news media was, they're right on it, right? So I decide I better go ask. So I go down to Florida with my BBC television crew and sit down to a very polite British interview with Clayton Roberts, who's the Florida chief of elections, kind of When you see Catherine Harris, you'll see like this bullet-headed little guy who's like a Doberman next to her leg all the time. That's Clayton. Clayton. And so I talked to Clayton. And I asked him about the election. He agreed to the interview. Then I pulled out this document, which he could see because it was big lettering, confidential, trade secret. And his eyes started shaking back and forth, and he's reading it upside down. He knows exactly what page I have, and I'm beginning to pull it out, and he whips off his microphone, does a 50-yard dash across the camera wires, runs into his office, locks the door, and calls in the state troopers to remove me and my camera crew from the state building. I guess he had another appointment. Or maybe it was something in the document. And what was in the document was, for $2 million, it says that the company would do something called manual verification using telephone calls. Now, I talked to a lot of database experts, so probably given the town we're in, there's probably some here will tell you that on really serious items, like when Victoria's Secret is trying to sell crotchless panties, they'll check their lists with phone calls, especially if it's important. The idea is that one of the reasons that this contract was supposed to be expensive is you have hundreds of people making phone calls to verify information about people to make sure they got the right Thomas Cooper, of which there are 77 in the Florida phone book alone. Okay? Now, so I called Database Technologies because they had to provide the documentation because they were acting for a public agency. So I said, could you please provide the experts, the database experts, somehow here in Seattle, by the way, I got a lot of volunteers, and I want to talk to you about that later, too. They said, ask for the call sheets. I called, and I said, can I have the call sheets? I said, yeah, we usually have call sheets. That's right. And I said, could you give me the call sheets for this contract? He said, we don't have any. And I said, what do you mean you don't have any? He says, manual verification using telephone calls. And he says, well, in this case, the telephone calls didn't involve dialing a telephone. All right. Now, okay, you're like Seattle, right? So like it's West Coast, so it's like, this was like really new age, you know? Didn't involve dialing a telephone. So I'm doing this, so I'm saying, I'm gonna clear my head and try to understand clearing. No dialing the telephone. And I couldn't get it. I couldn't get it. That's why I went down to Clay and asked him. And I have a photocopy to check for the phone calls that weren't dialed. The phone is no phone, right? And so you saw that, you heard about that on CBS television, right?
Yeah.
CBS television did call me, Dan Rather's operation. I want to talk about Dan because CBS television called me and said, what a great story. Give us a piece of it, would you? Come on. And I said, well, you're a competitor on BBC, but okay, I'll give you something. I'm an American. I want this story to come out. So they said, give us something new and special. We're down in Florida. Run it tonight. This is, you know, everything is tonight. Special investigation. 12 seconds. And so I said, you know what? It's not just Catherine Harris and her office and her predecessor involved in this. It was Jeb Bush's office got involved. Jeb Bush's office, my information says, sent out a letter which ordered elections supervisors in the county to remove legal voters. September 18th, 2000. I've heard about this letter. I've read this letter. I have every word of it, but I don't have the physical letter. Check this out. This is what Bush did. And so now, you know what Bush did is that I said, now it's a little complicated. Whoa, and then I realized, I just said complicated to American network producer. I said, don't worry, we can get it so Dan can read it. You know, I don't want to confuse you. So I said, it's a little complicated. What it is remember the 90.2% of the people on the list were innocent? Well, there are a lot of felons in Florida who can vote. You don't necessarily lose your vote if you get clemency. Okay? If you get clemency, or you come from another state. Because if you come from the state of Washington, In fact, about 1964, the state of Washington, which was the only state in the North to take away people's civil rights if they were convicted of a felony, during the middle of the civil rights era, got rid of that law. So if you come from the state of Washington, you're convicted of a felony after 1964, you have the right to vote restored. And you don't lose it just because you moved to Florida. In fact, the courts have twice told Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris, stop taking away people's civil rights just because they move to the state of Florida. You're still part of the United States, whether you like it or not. Okay? Right? It was part of a... And these court orders came down before the election. Before the election. Because there was a law in effect at that time called the U.S. Constitution. That's what the law was, and will be, if we have something to do. Anyway, so I gave this story to CBS, but despite the court orders and everything, Bush's office, governor's office, sent out a letter saying, remove these people. And I looked through this list, and I counted 2,873 people on this list who fell into that category. People, there were like 40 people from Washington State here who had moved to Florida, and they had the right to vote. And they were on that list. And they were removed. Do the arithmetic. Oh, by the way, here's something you may not know. If you want to know how that affected the election, 2,873 votes, 537 determined the election. Democratic Party may not want to tell you this. If you go to jail, whether you're black, you're white, you're rich, you're poor, you come out and you're a Democrat. Go to jail, you come out a Democrat. I don't know. You know, you may not reform, you may go back and commit other crimes, but you become a Democrat. People, that's what the demographics are, and they know it. They know it, the Republicans. You knock out ex-felons, and you've knocked out 93% are Democrats. And they're not guessing because they know the rich. You know. So, and about 50,000 people minimum, according to experts at the University of Minnesota. I had them check it out for Nation magazine. They said at least 50,000 people were prevented from registering that had the legal right to register, almost all Democrats. Yeah, I know one election supervisor, by the way, told me she refused to violate the law. She said, I'm not going to jail for Jeb. But another one throughout the list because Linda Howell, I like her from Washington County, and she's a Republican, and she stood up against the list and threw it out because Linda Howell's on the list. Now I'm an investigative reporter, so I said, Linda, confess. She said, I'm not a felon. I said, well, prove it. Because under Jeb's law, you'd have to then, he did say there was an out. You could go and ask Jeb then for clemency, which he did grant. 30,000 people asked. He hardly handed out a single one, except he did allow Chuck Colson to vote. I wonder who voted. Anyway, CBS, remember the CBS report? So you saw that on CBS. What happened was they didn't run it that night. And they didn't run it the next night or the next night. And then I called them and said, what happened to the story I gave about Jeb Bush in the letter of September 18th and ordering, whether you had the letter or not, you could go and check out that the supervisors were ordered to remove these legal voters. And they said, CBS Dan Rather's operation, we investigated and your story didn't stand up. Now I get this all the time from U.S. news producers, U.S. reporters and newspapers. Your story, Greg, your story didn't stand up. Okay, you know, but that could be true too. So I said, what was your investigation? The story didn't stand up. And they said, well, we called Jeb Bush's office. And they said, you know, he didn't do it. Okay. Despite that exhaustive investigation by CBS, I decided to check it out myself. And in fact, I called. It was interesting, Indie Media here, the Indie Media affiliate in London filmed me calling the Florida Secretary of State's office, Jeb Bush's office. And I said, I knew the date. I said, can I have a letter from your files dated September 18th, 2000, in which the governor orders the removal of felon voters from other states? Could you please send me that information? Oh, we don't have such a letter. Now it's the end of February, and the Civil Rights Commission has already gotten my information on this. And they started asking Jeb to produce his records because the general counsel said, this is evidence of deliberate attempt to violate the civil rights of American citizens. And the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, which is called biased, meaning that they had black people on it. The lawyer was black. And they wanted this evidence. So Bush sent them evidence, and he sent, and they said, well, we don't have, this is the beginning of March, we don't have such a document. That letter doesn't exist. I said, it doesn't exist. You should. It's September 18th. I even signed by a Janet Keels. I have information. I can even read you the words. It doesn't exist. We do have a letter dated February 23rd, 2001. I said, and they sent that to me, faxed that to me, this letter here. And this is kind of interesting because it says, Janet Keels, seal, says, and it says, if people come from out of state who have a criminal record, but their rights come from states like Washington, please help them register to vote. Very nice, clean, honest. Okay, that's our policy. It says, some confusion has recently arisen regarding the effect, it's like some confusion has arisen. Uh-huh. Maybe an investigation has arisen. But I don't know, I don't want to be a conspiracy nut. So, but I said, could you check the governor's files, not there. And what about the computers? I mean, this stuff wasn't written in Quill, I assume. I mean, it was, it must, why don't you check the computers? And not there. Not there. Now, pick up this month's Harper's. Because it has Catherine Letters, Catherine Harris's screed. It goes on and on. Don't blame, you're twisted and maniacal. Don't blame me. She said, don't blame me. It's the legislature. It's the attorney general. Everyone told me to do all these things, including, and I got a letter from Jeb Bush before the election. I called up the Secretary of State's office a couple of weeks ago. And I said, I have a letter from your Secretary of State. I didn't say it started out, that started out calling me twisted and maniacal. I just said I got a letter, and it references a letter from Governor Bush to regarding felons out of state, da-da-da-da-da. Could you please fax that to me? September 18th, 2000. February 23rd. So before the election, remove them. Democrats, find them, hunt them down, get them around. And after the election, Democrats may vote. Well, but now it will be investigated by Mr. Ashcroft. I'm sure we'll do a heck of a job getting behind that one. And the Washington Post, they're on the case. Oh, I shouldn't knock them because they did run my story. This is how I end up in trouble. The Ted Koppel, great guy. And I have a deal with Ted Koppel. I mean, the BBC and ABC have this film trading agreement. I'm BBC News Night, he's ABC Nightline. We can trade film for free. Now, free in American enterprise is a really good price. So they could get my stories for free, but they decided not to, even though people suggest that they run some of my stories, like Clayton Roberts running away and all that. You get it for free. They didn't want it. They said, we're going to do our own investigation. Because one thing I did discover quite rapidly was that despite the fact that James Baker told you that there were that the votes were counted six times in Florida, and he's, we trust him, but in fact, they were all counted six times except for 180,000 ballots. 180,000 ballots were never counted because they were spoiled. That raised the question to me, how do you spoil a ballot? Do you leave it out of the fridge too long? What does it mean, a spoiled ballot? Spoiled ballot, so it says it's, for some reason, it can't be counted. Because Florida law says you have to try to determine voters' intent. And so spoiled ballots include those, and I saw these, which were in which the name Al Gore was checked and Al Gore was written in. Can you guess the intent of the voter? Spoiled. Al Gore's name circled, not checked. etc. But the most interesting thing about the spoiled ballots is that not all, everybody's ballot was spoiled so easily for reasons that are very interesting. Whether your ballot spoiled or not had to do with the color of the voter. Because 100 of the 67 counties in Florida, the number of spoiled ballots was almost, in county to county, was in direct proportion to the number of black people in the county. Interesting. Ted Koppel and his team are on the case. They go down. Why is it that all these black ballots were spoiled? And he gets professors and experts, and they say, well, you know, Jesse Jackson registered all these thousands of new voters, and they're really, you know, they don't have, they're not necessarily very educated, and they're not used to the ballots, and it's very difficult, and the ballots are very sophisticated and hard to understand, and in other words, blacks is too dumb to vote. Now, if that's true, okay, we'll have to live with that racist conclusion. It's a racist remark, but it may be true, okay? I'll take a look myself. And I go down to Leon County, Tallahassee, the capital. But Leon County is where it's situated. Go into the office of the election supervisor, terrific guy, Ian Sancho. And he's got a voting box set up. And they look a lot like this, a voting booth, a voting machine. Most counties, you've heard all about the Chads and the butterflies. Most of the counties don't use Chads and butterflies and all that stuff. They use paper ballots, which is still the best way to vote because you can leave a paper trail. Catherine Harris wants to change the voting systems, by the way, to touch screen voting. I just want to know who else is touching the screen. Catherine. Okay, so I check it. So I take a ballot. I go up to it. You can practice voting or whatever. And I mark off, and this is really true. I marked off, who I voted for, Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader. And then there's a little slot at the top, and you stick the ballot, the paper ballot, in. And then it went back in my hand. Okay. So I try to stick it back in. I kind of shove it back in, and it came back in my hand. Like, you know, like when you put in a kind of crap dollar or into one of those change machines or something. So I call over a clerk. I say, whoa, what is this? He says, well, you marked off two presidential candidates. You can't do that. You can't, because then the machine won't be able to read it. It knows you made a mistake, and it gives it back to you. We give you a new ballot, and we vote again. You get three ballots in Florida to try again. Very easy to make a wrong marker. Vote wrong on these things. We show you what mistake you made. I said, wait, but how do the ballots spoil then? I mean, you can't make a mistake. She says, yeah, it's really hard. It says, in our county, only 1 in 200 votes was spoiled. I said, but what about Gadsden? Now, Gadsden is right next door to Leon County, but there's a difference between Leon, which is white, and Gadsden, which is 57% black, the blackest county of 67 in Florida, which also had the highest number of spoiled ballots. 1 in 8 votes in Gadsden was not counted. 1 in 8 people in the blackest county of Florida, their votes didn't count. Literally. So how can that happen? They have a different setup. They use Chads or butterflies. No. They had the same paper ballot and these machines, optical readers too. I said, but I don't get it. How could 1 in 8 ballots be spoiled? She said, well, see, this reject mechanism, you got to set the buttons, you know. It's how you set the program the machine. Oh. So it ain't that black voters was too dumb to vote, but that white reporters was too dumb to ask. And the Washington Post is on that because the day before yesterday they finally ran a story saying, you know what, there's difference in voting, in Leon County you can, these white counties you can get your ballot back, and in black counties you couldn't. Not that there's any racial implication in that. It's Washington Post. We need voting reform. Yeah. Maybe we need newspaper media coverage reform. The story of the election. I'm a business reporter. I follow the money. I mean, that's my thing. And so I started out. I was covering the election. I was covering who gave the money for this election. I was fascinated with the fact that there was $250,000 given for $250 million raised by the Democratic Party in that election cycle, with not just Democrats but the parallel spending in the rest. And the Republicans get W elected, and the Republicans spent about $400 million, including parallel spending from like Mr. Gates, and which is off the record, but about $400 million altogether, so it's nearly $500 million. I'm thinking, kind of interesting, instead of an election, it would have been more efficient instead of an election to have an auction, right? But I said, who's giving this money? Who's giving this money? And I'm going through the usual list of suspects to start. The number one giver for the Republican Party is Enron. Number two is Exxon. Number three is a company called Southern Company. We'll talk about them. But then near the top, under the B's, is a company called Barrick Gold Mining. Now, I never heard of Barrick Gold Mining, so it literally piqued my interest. I said, well, who the heck is Barrick and why? And it was interesting, Barrick Gold Mining of Canada. Now, why would the Canadians be so patriotic as to support our democratic process and give money to the Republicans and a couple of Democrats as well? You know, you may be able to buy the Republican Party, but you can only rent the Democrats, right? And but who are these characters? And they did through the U.S. subsidiary. It's nice and legal. And I'm looking at the Barrick Gold and their websites and all that. And who's on their international board of directors, board of advisors, as they call them, but George Herbert Walker Bush. He went to work for them, apparently, after he left the White House. When I say he left, I mean two-thirds of the American people asked him to leave. That's right. Have faith. Okay. Now, I looked around. Now, there's no guy named Joe Barrick or Sid Barrick. Who is Barrick Gold Mine? So I'm looking, and it's that well-known Canadian, the guy that's founded the company, whose money founded the company, is that well-known Canadian, Adnan Khashoggi. Oh, that rang a bell. If you remember, Khashoggi was the arms dealer, the bag man. He's a billionaire Saudi Arabian arms dealer who gave guns the Ayatollah Khomeini in return for funding the hostages, buying off the hostages in Lebanon in return for funding illegally the Contras, right? So that was the Iran-Contra scandal. And he was the bag man in that story, which is interesting. In other words, our Bush Sr. went to work for the man who armed the Axis of Evil. But, you know, the guy's got to work, right? And so so I'm wondering about this. But then I said, but why? What would they want, you know, what do you want to use president for? Anyway, I mean, why hire him? He's out of office, isn't he? I mean, was there something that was done that they were grateful for? Sure enough, I look, Bureau of Land Management. There's a Mineral Claims Act, Mineral Mining Act of 1873, which allowed miners during the gold rush to make claims on a property. You know, you remember his Treasure Sierra Madre, there was the guy with the funny hat and donkey, and he has the pan of gold, and he says, you know, pans gold, finds gold nugget, says, Eureka, I found it, runs off the claims office, stakes a claim, puts down $5, and gets an acre of land that he can mine, okay? Bush's administration, just before he left, established an expedited procedure to perfect claims, that's the legal term, perfect the claim, on gold mines. And one gold mining company that took advantage of this, and apparently the only one, maybe the only one, but there was a $10 billion ore body, $10 billion worth of gold in Nevada. Maybe certainly the biggest gold mine in America, maybe the world. The claim was perfected under a special expedited procedure for a payment to the U.S. Treasury of a little less than $10,000. Eureka. Someone found it, huh? And that was Barrick Gold Mining of Canada. Yeah. What was the last thing that Daddy Bush did before he left office? Pardoned Adnan Khashoggi of his crimes. Pardoned him, went to work. Okay, so I thought this was interesting. I reported it, and my paper got sued. Guardian newspapers, like kind of Washington Post of Britain, and its Sunday paper as well, which is The Observer, which I read a column. We were sued. No First Amendment in Britain, which is why we have a 4th of July. There's no written constitution. There's no freedom of the press. This is serious stuff. And one of the reasons I can report what I do is that the paper is owned by a not-for-profit charitable trust. It's not on the money making. But it can't defend against, you know, an enraged billionaire. By this time, Khashoggi had taken the money and ran. Bush had resigned to work on his son's campaign. But the company was there and sued. Because what they said was not that these individual facts were wrong, the pardon, the mine, the money. They said a reasonable, under British law, I just have to prove that someone could read this in a defamatory manner. What they said was that a reasonable person reading these separate facts might believe that there's a connection. All right. So I don't want to sink my paper. So I said, okay, no problem. Besides, my job as a reporter is to lay out the dots and you draw the lines. Anyway, so save my paper. Said, go ahead. No connection. So that's our theme tonight. You know, so I don't want anyone here getting me in trouble making connections. So let's review that. Khashoggi got the gold mine. The public got the shaft. Daddy got the job. Sonny got the money. And there are no connections. Careful. You too might be a conspiracy nut and think that, you know, like that they sold guns to the Ayatollah in return for funding the Contras.
This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 or Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're listening to a talk by investigative journalist Greg Pallast, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. We continue.
Yeah. Oh, but what did Bush do after for Barrick Gold Mining of Canada? I went on their website and said the International Advisory Board, which is Bush and Brian Mulroney, the U.S. Prime Minister of Canada, and a couple of other characters, helped Barrick obtain a gold mining concession in Tanzania. Okay, I don't know. What do I know? So I look it up. Sometimes I wish I don't look these things up, because what I found out is that they began trying to get this concession in about 1994, 95. It was owned by another Canadian company, Sutton Resources, this gold property in Tanzania. It was worthless because there were already miners on it. You know, guys with funny hats and donkeys, small-scale miners. 30,000 miners already had permits for the land. They're Tanzanians. So the Canadians couldn't come in, or the American-Canadian-Saudi operation couldn't move in because the Tanzanians were still there. And the courts there ruled that, in fact, the 30,000 miners there had the right to be there, because they had permits. They had their little claim things. And so in August 1996, and one midnight, they rolled Sutton Resources, rolled bulldozers across the property, and smashed down all the workers' homes, followed by military police firing weapons. They smashed down their homes. They destroyed their equipment. They filled in all the mining pits. All the miners were chased off the property permanently. Except for 50 miners who were still in their mining pits when they were covered over. That's our information.